Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Gregory Pfeiffer, a former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, who has reported from Russia for almost a decade. In 2008, he covered the Russia-Georgia war from the breakaway Georgian region of South Ossetia and traveled to Siberia, Belgrade, and Berlin to produce a series on the Kremlin's use of Gazprom, the Russian gas monopoly, as an instrument of foreign policy. He witnessed the coup d'etat attempt against Mikhail Gorbachev in 1991 and later examined the end of the Yeltsin era and Russia's subsequent transformation into an authoritarian state. Pfeiffer, whose mother is Russian, lived in Paris and New York and is the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler with former KGB General Viktor Chekhushin. His latest book just out is Russians, The People Behind the Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
And your book takes the reader from the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991 to Putin's re-election for a third term as president in 2012. And just on Monday, there were 500 people arrested for rallies both in Moscow and St. Petersburg in support of seven people who received prison terms for demonstrating against Putin's inauguration for his third presidential term. So there's the kind of bookends there, I guess. Among them were some fairly prominent opposition figures, Alexei Navalny, two of the Pussy Riot band members who were just released from prisons, and former Deputy Prime Minister Boris Nemtsov. What I find disturbing about this, Gregory, is the way that the Russian media, which is totally controlled by Putin, praised the arrests and linked them to the events in Kiev in the Maidan, saying it's even more obvious that what all of this could have led to had it not been for the government's clear, tough response. So there you have, you know, the government praising the arrest of dissidents and linking them to the terrorists, as they call them, in Kiev. So it's a pretty sad day for the Russian opposition, wouldn't you say?
It is indeed. I think the lesson that Vladimir Putin has drawn from the events in Ukraine is precisely not to let that kind of thing happen in Russia. Now, he's not going to do that by opening up political system in any way, increasing free speech. He's doing it by cracking down against all of his rivals. And he's been remarkably consistent. This is something he's done from the very first day he came to power in 2000. He has slowly gotten rid of his rivals, cracked down on civil society, and the thing that I think that he's very successful at doing and has been from the start is presenting different faces to different people. I don't know if you remember the first 4 years of his presidency during his first term, he was hailed in the West as a great reformer. I remember he traveled to London in 2003 to meet Tony Blair, and the Times of London called him the greatest Russian ruler since Alexander II, who freed the serfs in 1861. He's a master of appearances. He appears tough when he wants to. He appears more conciliatory and even sometimes fuzzy and warm, like he did to some people during the Sochi Winter Olympics that just ended. And I think he's done that by essentially tapping into a centuries-old political culture in Russia. This is part of his success. He's been able to use facades, often facades that are taken from adopting to Western influences, and using them to hide what really has been a very traditional Russian system where decisions are made in secret and essentially are covered up. This is what I talk about in the book.
But at this point, events, I mean, in many ways, his policy makes what's happening in Ukraine and Kiev a zero-sum game. He basically said to Yanukovych, you know, it's either us or the EU, and it's going to have to be us, and we'll give you $15 billion. And that's already blown up in his face. But in covering the events in Ukraine, Russian media, which is entirely controlled by Putin, has demonized the opposition to the point calling them terrorists, and even the Prime Minister Medvedev said the other day that that was an armed mutiny. So I'm wondering if Russia can, have they trapped themselves? Have the leadership trapped themselves in this kind of rhetoric that would, on the part of their public, expect some kind of intervention in Ukraine?
Well, I think the Kremlin has shown itself to be pragmatic at times. Putin has often in the past supported authoritarian leaders who have been toppled. He supported them to the very last minute and then essentially changed his tune. We saw that with Slobodan Milosevic in 2001. Putin was his staunch ally till the last minute. And after he was arrested by the Serbian authorities, he immediately quieted down. The Kremlin has not so far intervened using force in Ukraine. That was the biggest fear. But I think it will continue to use various underhanded methods, essentially using its old playbook to try to bribe and threaten the Ukrainians to abandon joining the EU and looking west and try to forge closer ties with Russia. Now, officials in the EU in the West rightly say that this doesn't need to be a choice, that it's not a zero-sum game. But for Putin, it is. And part of the reason, I think, is that he makes decisions that are in his interest, not in Russia's or the Russian people's. Things like directing or threatening to direct nuclear missiles at Western Europe and over the years cutting off gas to Ukraine has been very bad for Russia's image in the world. But at home, it's shown Putin to be tough, and that's helped shore up his base of conservative voters. You know, we've just seen in Ukraine that Putin has helped push the country to the verge of civil war by pressuring the Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych to abandon a deal with the EU last year. So, you know, I think that these things are all, as I say, good for Putin because they show him to be trying to restore Russia's greatness. He wants Ukraine to join the so-called Eurasian Union, which would be an organization that counters the West. Without Ukraine, this organization would essentially be toothless. Ukraine is too big and important a partner for Russia. So I think he will continue to do that. After the Orange Revolution in 2004, the Kremlin was very worried that the same thing could happen in Moscow, very worried that it was losing its influence in its backyard. But I think Putin has learned lessons, and I think he's sort of playing a long game. Ukraine isn't going anywhere, and Russia will keep doing what it's been doing in the past.
Again, I'm speaking with Gregory Pfeiffer, a former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, who has reported from Russia for almost a decade. He is the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler with former KGB Colonel Viktor Cherashkin. And his latest book just out is Russians, The People Behind the Power. Well, we have, of course, the interim president of the Ukraine warning of dangers of separatism. Apparently, the Russian-speaking regions to the east are not recognizing this government. And, of course, Yanukovych is on the lam. His aide was apparently shot in the leg. Do you think that there is any possibility of the Ukraine breaking up?
I think certainly there's a possibility. I don't think it's a very big possibility. I do think Ukrainians, despite their differences, want to remain together in one country. We've seen that this is a country that has a very strong civil society despite the authoritarianism. We've seen people rise up and topple their very corrupt authoritarian leader. These differences are historic. Ukraine is split essentially 50-50 between its Russian-speaking east and Ukrainian-speaking, generally Ukrainian-speaking west. It's also divided 50-50 by population. This is one of the reasons that this conflict in Ukraine is so intractable. But I think we saw signs before Yanukovych came to power in 2010 of the two sides kind of warming to each other. And I think that the candidacy of Yulia Tymoshenko, the former prime minister who ran for president and was narrowly defeated by Yanukovych in 2010, there were signs that her campaign was bringing the two sides together, that people in the east were beginning to support her, and that a sense of sort of national unity was emerging. I think it's very possible. I think Ukrainians on the whole want to look west. They want to join the EU. This is why they rose up when Yanukovych had been in power for several years. He'd done some terrible things. He'd jailed Tymoshenko. He'd cracked down on the free press. It was well known that he was corrupt, but it was the decision to abandon a deal with the EU that prompted these protests. So I think there is a desire for that, and I'm optimistic, despite the fragile nature of the attempts to form a unity government now. I'm optimistic that Ukraine can do so.
Well, certainly if Tymoshenko is the anointed leader, that's a step backwards. She's a minor kleptocrat compared to Yanukovych, of course, who his oldest son, the dentist, shook down the billionaires, and overnight they become one of the richest families in Ukraine. But she, of course, Yulia Tymoshenko, has one of her closest aides was arrested for money laundering, and the assumption is it's her money that he was laundering, and she was a catastrophe as prime minister. So one would hope that new leadership could emerge, and as you've mentioned, Gregory Pfeiffer, the Russians are going to meddle as much as they can and thwart any movement towards the West. But given the choice between a kind of gangster regime in the East and joining a civil society in the West, a country that's rife with corruption, which is weighing down any chances of forming businesses and affecting the daily lives of every Ukrainian who have to pay bribes, the choice would seem pretty clear. Why is there no such choice in Russia? In other words, people accept Putin, if not like him, and the reformers, those people that were just arrested on Monday, have very little traction.
That's a very, very good question. I'd just like to say two words about Tymoshenko, and that is I can't agree with your assessment. Yes, she did amass a huge fortune in the natural gas business, the very murky natural gas business in the 90s. She made a lot of mistakes as prime minister, but she learned from her lessons. I think that she also essentially sacrificed a lot of her political power in the years leading up to the election of Yanukovych, staving off his attacks on the essentially the Orange Revolution team that was in government. So yes, she is a problematic figure, but many, many politicians are. I think she's one of the better candidates. She's been staunchly pro-EU. She has learned from her mistakes. She's a very charismatic figure. I don't necessarily think that her presidency would be a step backward. But let me just say about Russia, why is it that Russians aren't rising up like the Ukrainians did? And this is really the question at the heart of my book. Why is it that two decades after the Soviet collapse, do Russians continue to support their authoritarian leader who's destroyed democracy and jailed his political opponents? Does that mean that they've learned absolutely nothing from their painful past? My approach in my book has been to look at Russians' daily behavior, their family life, their work, drinking. And what's clear to me in my travels, many travels across Russia, is that Russians' way of doing things may seem odd and confusing and chaotic to us, but it is successful in achieving its own aims. Now, these aren't Western aims. I think Russians' values and motives are different than ours, but they do function according to their own internal logic, and that's something that we really need to understand.
So how much, though, did the failure of Yeltsin contribute to this jaundiced view of Western democracy?
I don't think Yeltsin is necessarily a failure. I think he did a lot of good for the country. A lot of reforms were made in the 1990s that gave hope that the country could fundamentally change. And I think it's still possible that the country can change, because I think that Russians' behavior needn't be as mysterious as it seems to us. I think it's based on, its own internal logic, and it's based on practical reasons. Putin came to power when Yeltsin was sick. The country was suffering from economic crisis in 1998, and he was picked to succeed Yeltsin in the hope that he would be able to protect the Yeltsin circle, Yeltsin's entourage. This is somebody who was basically an unknown with no power base of his own, and he was a brilliant student of the traditional Russian political system, not only under the Soviet Union, but for hundreds of years under the Tsars, and he was able to essentially reactivate it. I'll just give you an example. The conventional wisdom is that Putin essentially established an unwritten social contract with the people, that he was been in power for 14 years, because as long as living standards continue rising, thanks to the country's vast natural energy resources, basically the Kremlin is more or less free to be as authoritarian as it likes. I don't believe that's true. I think that the real glue binding Putin's system to the Russian people is corruption. I think that bribery, I mean, we all know, it's well known that bribery affects absolutely everybody. If you drive a car, you are inevitably stopped by the traffic police, and you inevitably pay a bribe to get out of it. If you're the owner of a corner store, for example, you pay the building inspector, the fire code inspector, the health code inspector. Now, this enables the authorities pretty much to prosecute anybody, because anybody can be accused of wrongdoing. So I think bribery coerces people. But I also think it co-opts people, because I think that people feel that they're getting at least something out of the system, that they have a stake in it too. So, for example, the corner store owner who pays the police to ensure that no harm comes to his business, maybe he feels that he's got something over his competition a couple blocks down the street.
So you don't think that in the end of the day that's corrosive, though? I mean, it seems to be that way in the Ukraine.
Certainly, it is corrosive. It's very, very difficult for Putin to control the system. And although he has control over parliament and the courts and the state media, it's a very shaky control, because he doesn't have a popular mandate in that he wasn't elected in free and fair elections. And essentially, his system consists of, governing system consists of appointing regional thugs, sort of the biggest thugs in the provinces, to be sort of loyal leaders. You know, do whatever you want in your region, but make sure you're loyal to the Kremlin. But I think one of the reasons that he's been able to do this successfully is that, as I said earlier, that he's been able to present these facades. Now, I think this is something that Russian leaders have often done in the past, adopting foreign influences that resulted in what turned out to be clearly more traditionally Russian. From the laws of Catherine the Great that omitted many elements of Enlightenment thought that she said they reflected, to the tone and practice of Soviet communism, which surely would have dumbfounded Marx. Now, I think one of the clearest examples of this was the presidency of Putin's protege Dmitry Medvedev, who took office after Putin's first two consecutive term limit ran out. Now, Western leaders spent the 4 years of his tenure trying to guess when this man would assume the vast powers of his office. But, of course, as we know now, that never happened, and Putin returned to his old job. And that's because Medvedev's sort of reforming Western-looking image served to conceal the real ruler, Putin. And I think this sort of creating a facade, obfuscating what's going on, enables Putin to successfully rule as he has done for 14 years, and he doesn't look like he's stepping down anytime soon.
Well, I guess that's kind of the Matryoshka metaphor, right? The riddle and wrapped in an enigma. But you say that in your book, Gregory Pfeiffer, Russians, the people behind the power, that Putin is chief among a collection of officials whose rule more closely resembles those of mafia dons than public servants. And I'm wondering, there was a recent expose on what happened to the lawyer Magnitsky on 60 Minutes, which was quite damning. And for the longest time, I've talked to Russian specialists and people like Masha Gessen and Nina Khrushcheva and others who obviously don't like what's been happening in Russia over the last decades or so through Putin. And I'm wondering what the advantage of treating this guy with respect is, you know, because one of the things that gangsters yearn for is respect. And it seems that there's so much smoke in terms of his thuggishness, let alone presiding over and regulating the other thugs, that one wonders exactly whether, you know, you're dealing with. I mean, it's the same thing in effect that happened between Chamberlain and Hitler with the famous Munich Pact, where historians have concluded that Chamberlain, being an old-fashioned English gentleman, simply didn't realize he was dealing with a gangster and a thug who took him to the cleaners. And that appears to be what's been happening lately. It looks like Putin's taken us to the cleaners over Syria, for example.
I couldn't agree with you more. You know, we wonder why Putin does these kinds of things, put egg on President Obama's face over Syria, his actions in Ukraine. And, you know, as I was saying, I think we have a tendency to find Russia a riddle, as Churchill said, or we explain what we don't understand about Russians by saying, well, you know, they have a mystical Russian soul that's that we can't understand because it's different. As I said, I think that our sort of the beginning of our dealing with Putin in the right way, and I agree with you that this is somebody who craves respect, and that we have to understand that, is precisely to understand his motives, which are very clear. They're not a mystery. So, for example, you know, Putin has generated a great deal of bad press by jailing Pussy Riot and passing an anti-gay law, among many other relatively recent restrictions. But that's politically smart. You know, polls say that almost two-thirds of Russians condemn homosexuality as morally unacceptable. You know, Putin's nationalism works because many Russians envy the West, and they support his claims of Russian exceptionalism. You know, I once heard a joke that Americans love their country and hate everyone who disagrees with them, and that Russians dislike their country and hate everyone who agrees with them. Now, you know, that may be a bit harsh, but you know, although today is a far cry from the Cold War, Putin does regularly denounce the United States, and it's popular. As I say, I think the trick is to understand why he's doing these things, and I don't think we do. I think we continue to think of Putin as a rational character in the Western sense, and so we're always surprised why, as I say, he takes decisions in his own interests and not in his country's. But I do think that Russia can change. I don't believe it's fated to remain the same. You know, I think the society is changing, and I think now the economy is creating a lot of pressure on Putin. Russia's dominance over the energy market, exports to Europe, is wavering. Russia, the economy inside Russia is starting it's not starting to decline, but economic growth certainly is starting to decline to very small numbers at the same time that dependence on oil is growing. I mean, in 2005, Russia could balance its budget if oil was around $20 a barrel. Today, it has to be around $103. Now the price for Russian oil is around $108. So the Kremlin is very worried what will happen if oil continues to fall. And I think this also partly accounts for, you know, the crackdown against protesters, the nationalism, the desire to appear strong.
Again, let me remind the audience I'm speaking with Gregory Pfeiffer, former Moscow correspondent for National Public Radio, who has reported from Russia for almost a decade. He is the author of The Great Gamble, A History of the Soviet War in Afghanistan, and co-author of Spy Handler with former KGB Colonel Viktor Cherkashin. His latest book just out is Russians, The People Behind the Power. It couldn't be more topical given the conversation, since so much of Russia has been in the news, not just with the recent Olympics, but now with this new possible crisis, even a revival of kind of Cold War hostilities over Ukraine. Clearly, it would be a massive loss to Russia to have Ukraine move into the Western orbit, and it would be a disaster for Ukraine to split between its Eastern minority and its Western majority. So what's your sense then of the takeaway from your book?
Well, the takeaway is that although Russians' behavior seems confusing and confounding to foreigners, that really if you look at patterns and behavior, that it's really quite understandable. It's based on practical reasons, but these are practical reasons that come from the system's own internal logic. Russians share different values than we do in the West. They share different goals, and I think that one of the tasks in front of us is to try to understand them. I think Russia can change, but I think that reforming the country will take more than just new leadership. It will require a fundamental change precisely in that behavior that makes it seem so mystifying to us today.
Well, I spent through the Cold War a lot of time in Russia working on arms control and also working in the anti-nuclear movement with the nuclear freeze here in California and working for a group in Washington, the Center for Defense Information, about the possibility of a nuclear war, which was a real issue, a real and growing, a clear and present danger back then. And it is a miracle that we survived the Cold War, given how many near misses and misperceptions, and much of that still is classified to this day. But, you know, I've always had this tremendous affection for the Russian people, and it always seemed like such an unnecessary and unnatural competition. There's no inherent reason for the Russians and the Americans to oppose each other and to be enemies. There's no historical or cultural motivation, really. It just seems to be an accident of history. And it seems such a great tragedy that we're heading back into that direction.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think that Russian behavior has been influenced over centuries by some of the country's distinctive characteristics. It's the biggest country in the world by territory. Much of its land is uninhabitable. It's marsh and tundra. It has a famously terrible winter. I think all of these things do affect behavior. But I don't believe that means that it's fated to continue doing the same things over and over again. And I think also that these characteristics have also helped fuel a tremendous creativity in art, in dancing, in literature, and many other endeavors. You know, Russia is a country of huge paradoxes. You know, the vast size, the immense wealth in some things, and the terrible, terrible poverty. I mean, if you just look at it today, we had the spectacle of the Olympic Games, you know, the most expensive games ever, famously corrupt. And yet you have a country where the countryside is literally dying. I mean, I visit villages where there's one or two elderly people left living in what used to be villages but is now an abandoned, muddy track. Disease, alcoholism kills a fifth of Russian men. You know, in many ways, this is a country that's heading toward crisis. On the other hand, it's a country in which its creative people, trying to struggle with these paradoxes, come up with amazing literature, amazing art. And so it's a place that just continues to fascinate.
Well, Gregory Pfeiffer, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.